All right. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning,
Jeremy. Here we go. I was telling Wayne earlier, each time I get up here to do this, this is technically my third time, and each time I'm wondering, is this going to be the last time they let me do this? I'm picking up as we go through our Shalom series. We are in this quadrant of Shalom with each other, and as I titled this, I actually, first off, we were saying Shalom with Humanity, which is a great all-encompassing. Catherine, a couple weeks back, used the words each other, and I really liked that, and that's why I kind of did that slide up that way, just because I like this idea. We can look at humanity as this big, broad, sort of outside thing, but I'm really excited to look at this as, especially as we get into these things today, I'm kind of like cushioning myself with what I'm going to say, but if we can look at this as each other, we're in this together, the people all around us. But today I've been kind of tasked with this idea of looking sort of how are we doing currently in this, and then also maybe kind of looking at it historically too, like how have we done this and how are we doing this? So if we want to, actually, you know what, you never do this when you get up and speak. Don't tell anybody you're nervous, but I am kind of nervous about what I'm going to say today. So I'm going to go ahead, and if you guys want to pray with me, let's go ahead and bow our heads and pray. Lord, thank you so much for this day, God. Thank you for everybody that is here and everybody that's watching at home. God, I ask that your words would speak through me today. I know it's easy to get in the way, but I don't believe that you're going to allow that to happen, God. So I ask that that hearts would be soft to hear what we have to say, and that you would use me, and God, please be graceful to what hits the ears of the people listening, Lord. We love you, we praise you, amen.
Amen.
All right. So, shalom with each other. We've used this sort of working definition in talking about shalom in these relationships, that shalom is this flourishing and abundant relationship lacking nothing. So what we're looking at today is this relationship, this flourishing and abundant relationship lacking nothing that we have with those around us, with the community and beyond. Those who are neighbors next door, but those who are living in the country, in the rest of the world and all that. So how do we do this? If we want to jump to the first slide. Well, there it is. It's really easy. Hebrews 12, 14 through 15 says, work at living in peace with everyone and work at living a holy life, for those who are not holy will not see the Lord. Of course, as we've maybe mentioned before in this series, the word shalom often gets, or always pretty much, gets translated into our Bibles now as the word peace. Now, that is that Irene, which is the Greek version of shalom in there, where it says living in peace. So we're supposed to work at living in this way. What I'm going to be doing today as we look at this, if we're going to be working at living in peace with everyone and trying to live a holy life, I'm going to do sort of this backdoor approach to it by looking at this last half of this verse, where it says, look after each other so that none of you fails to receive the grace of God. Watch out so that no poisonous root of bitterness grows up to trouble you, corrupting many. What I want to do is, having grown up in and around this sort of, I don't want to say broad definition, but this culture of evangelical Christianity, I want to kind of look at that and share sort of my observations of these places where some of these possible roots could sprout up. Now, Catherine shared this a couple weeks back, and I thought it was very important for me to repeat this as well, but she said no one reads the Bible from a neutral place, and she talked about how we all bring some of these unnoticed or unchallenged assumptions. So as I'm sharing this today, these are observations that I've made, but I also want us all being kind of open to look inward and see, because I know that there are some things, as I've grown in this and I've worked through these things, there are some of those assumptions, some of those things that are maybe critical in me, that these things that I want us all to be doing the work to kind of clear out. It's impossible We're always going to be reading through these lenses, but it's really helpful for us to try and be aware and open to look it through the eyes of others. So, as I'm looking at this and kind of looking at some of these places where these poisonous roots of bitterness may be growing out, I'm going to kind of look into this three sort of pronged thing. If you want to go to the next slide, I'm looking at those as these tactics used by empire. So if shalom is God's way, his system that he set for us to live into this flourishing and abundant life, lacking nothing, the opposite is empire, as we've said, which is destructive. It's closing in on life. It is trying to smash it out. And what I've kind of made up here is these are three tactics that I think, through my observations, that empire uses to do this. Now, this is obviously not all-encompassing, but as it says, if you want to read along, empire establishes hierarchy in order to leverage power. Empire views people as commodities or a sale to be made. And empire seeks to control behavior versus transforming hearts or to restrict life instead of producing fruit. Now, I'm going to use that sort of as our basis here, but going into our first section with that, of how I've witnessed empire kind of planting seeds that are growing into these roots that we've seen in the culture around us. Looking at that hierarchy idea, trigger warning, okay? These first words that are going to come up on the screen for some of us may be a little uncomfortable, but if you want to go to this next slide, one area that I've noticed in coming up through all this is this view of who has the power. Just like I said, empire establishes hierarchy to leverage power. This is what was often referred to, or this quote is kind of going along with what we talk about Aristotle's household code. Now, I don't know if many of you have ever read this, but so Aristotle said, the male is by nature superior and the female inferior. And the one rules and the other is ruled. This principle of necessity extends to all mankind. Of household management, we have seen that there are three parts. One is the rule of a master over slaves, another of a father, and a third of a husband. A husband and the father rules over wife and children. The reason I put that up there, you can go ahead and go to the next slide too. The reason I put that up there.
Okay. I love that scene.
Got to cushion the blow. All right. The reason I put that up there, because I think it's important for us to look at the context. This is the context. That's the structure of the culture to which Paul wrote these words when he said things like, wives, submit to your husbands. And he said, children, always obey your parents, for this pleases the Lord. And he said, slaves, obey your earthly masters. Now, many of us have heard those, and if you are raised within this culture of evangelical Christianity, that's probably pretty familiar to you, those words and this sort of unpacking of household code. If you're not, then I'm just doing a second part to Wayne's series of a different perspective. So, but if that is what you came up in, how many of you had ever heard that from Aristotle before? Well, I know my wife did because I read it to her last week, but. Okay, so as a majority, it seems like a lot of us didn't know that context. I think we all probably assumed that there was this, obviously we know there was this patriarchy in the Roman Empire. If you're a man, you probably think about it all the time. But we know that that was there, but for me, this was a really transformative thing to learn this context. Actually, digging into my little bit of study of household codes was a really therapeutic thing for me, and I was raised, and most of us kind of in this evangelical culture around us had this idea of what's called complementarianism. And if that's your source of upbringing and everything, first off, what I'm not saying, and I do not want this to be taken away, but what I'm not saying is that complementarianism is wrong, but what I am saying is there is a reason why I now identify myself as a flaming egalitarian. These are opposites. So what complementarianism says is that looking at male and female, that women and men are equal in value, but it will say different in roles. And it's within this structure that it's within this structure that a lot of church governing and all these positions of teaching, preaching, eldership, all these things over the years have been dominated by men. Maybe dominated, maybe not, hard word, I don't know. But looking at that context, saying that the Aristotle quote that we read, that's the context that Paul spoke those words into, I think you can easily make the connection that taken out of context, we can view those words of Paul and draw this idea that patriarchy, from reading that, is the divine structure set out. Now, what I believe we've done in doing that, again, going back to this hierarchy, establishing hierarchy to leverage power, I've watched that drawn out into a way where patriarchy, male headship, and all this stuff has been weaponized to rule over and hold down other positions. I believe that this is in contrast to shalom, because in my understanding, and I've said this a lot, it's like we've taken this family language that is relational, and in setting up this structure, then we take this family language and we sub it over and overlay it with more of a business structure. So now we have this business plan of there is, as you often hear said, the CEO pastor or the CEO father over the household. And now we have this this structure where there's a charge and a submission where we're treating each other more like bosses and employees. Now, if we're looking at this in the structure for family, and you can see how we can then draw this out into the broader context of living out church into our culture. From this, this hierarchy tactic of setting up this hierarchy and leveraging power gives way to, if you want to go to the next slide. This is probably one of the roots that I've noticed throughout my time that I've found to be totally destructive. And I think that this is something that a lot of people don't even notice how subtly it's mixed into our theology. But how many of you have ever heard of dominion theology? All right. I'm hoping from laying this out, if we have this structure of headship and rule over another, how we can draw that into this place where we get to this idea of dominion theology, where it says this is a group of Christian political ideologies that seek to institute a nation governed by Christians and based on their understandings of biblical law. The extensive rule and ways of acquiring these governing authority are varied. So the idea sort of overall is that we are to live in these power positions. And then so now through a very aggressive reading of Genesis 1:28, we look to that idea where God says, fill the earth and have dominion over it. We've drawn out this attitude through this threat of empire that we are to seek to do that outwardly, that Christians need to assume positions of power or push for representatives into positions of power to find places of dominion over. And the idea is to establish God's kingdom here on earth. Let me pick up where I am. I told you I was a little nervous, so I'm just going to cruise. Now, as we see this happening, going from men are to lead, then those of us who have been around this for a while have probably come through this idea of like, well, I've taken so many classes on how to be a leader. And we're told that all these positions, and then you see these things of like, well, how, biblical womanhood, biblical manhood, and all these things are taught to put us in these positions. But in taking that in this back direction, now we have this thing where we're trying to force these leadership positions, and now we're trying to grab for these leadership positions. And I think the early church would look at some of this stuff and see, are these even positions that we should or even could hold as Christians? Are we looking to govern everything? Are we looking to be in control over all of the schools and all these different areas in our life? Is that something that the way of shalom is calling us to do, to rule over? If you, I don't have all the history to go into how this has worked out through probably the last 100 years, but a big inspiration for me in kind of sharing this today, if you haven't read this book, I would highly recommend. If you're wondering how did we get to this position now where we're really trying to kind of hold everybody else down and have our positions of power, this book, Jesus and John Wayne by Christian Cobes de May, is a really great resource. For me, there were these things that I was watching happening around me, and I was super confused looking at this and thinking, like, am I crazy that I'm finding us hitch our wagon to different people in all these different sectors that did not look at all like Jesus? I watched people that I love and respect and still to this day kind of going in these directions of, like, well, we're going to back this person because they're going to get my agenda done. I watched all this happening, and I was like, how did we get here? How is this happening? Kristen does a really good job of breaking down the history of all of this. The goal that let me back up really quick. Once again, just making the disclaimer. This is an observation. This is not all-encompassing on how all this has gone, but I've watched people around me compromise our tactics in order to come to this idea that if it is this dominion, kingdom now thing, if we are to establish God's kingdom here on earth, it's more concerned now with, we got to get souls saved, we got to get more people on our team, and we got to get those people in the right positions in the right places so that we can make this into not just a Christian nation, but we got to make a Christian world in this. The actual name of one of those big movements is Kingdom Now, but that's what we're going for. We want to establish God's kingdom now. Moving on to my next part of the tactics of empire, we're going to move into our little viewing people as a commodity. But this right here, as it says, Seven Mountains Dominionism, also known as the Seven Mountains Mandate, this has become the most prevalent manifestation of the Kingdom Now theology, or I would say the Dominionism theology, as we talked about. And this mandate proposes there are seven mountains. See why I put the pretty mountain picture? Seven mountains that the Christians must control to establish a global Christian theocracy and to prepare the world for Jesus' return. These mountains are government, education, media, arts, entertainment, religion, family, and business. I kind of very loosely touched on this idea of government, but I'm a big fan of, there's a podcast called The Holy Post that is done by Phil Vischer. If you don't know Phil Vischer is the creator and also the character, Bob the Tomato in the VeggieTales. Phil Vischer is a very fun, rad guy, but through the podcast, The Holy Post, he coined a term that's kind of loosely being used now, but the term he coined is Christian Nashvilleism. So not to be confused with Christian nationalism, but Phil says Christian Nashvilleism is what happens when the center of gravity for this evangelical Christianity moves from these historic centers of thought, places like Wheaton College, Michigan, Illinois, these places where it was centered around Christian thought. It moves from those to centers of product and entertainment. He's using Nashville, but there, you know, I'm sure other places that could be thrown in there. But my thought is this. We have this goal, okay? If it's our goal to go out and establish God's kingdom and get everybody on our team, well, the easiest way to do this, right, is we got to package it and brand it. If we're going to get it sold, we got to make it happen. And this is what I believe we've watched occur all around us. For me, in my generation coming up, this sprouted forth on things like, I remember going to the Franklin Graham Fest. I remember going to, I'm sure a lot of us went to Promise Keepers. All these things sprouted up. Again, I'm not saying these things are bad. I had some wonderful experiences from these things. But looking at this idea of packaging it, from the inside growing up, especially growing up in, when I was in high school, I was both the president of the Bible club at my school, And I also had a foot-tall mohawk, and I was playing in punk rock bands. And that sort of bipolar existence has followed me through all of my life. So being in this, I was a part of it, but I was also very critical of it. And you can see that hasn't totally changed. But I went to these things, and I remember seeing, being part of the altar calls, watching it, the package kind of get so set that you can see it from a mile away. And again, being a little bit critical, especially as a teen and all this stuff, you would see things and be like, oh, that guy looks like he's a Christian from over there, or the way we dress, the clothes we wear, the sick, all these things kind of became part of the whole package. But if this goal was, in moving in this thread, to get us on our team, to get people into the club, in one way I've seen that at work as a disservice, is that's saving souls as the main goal has also pulled us out of this, the center of things like social justice. If we're concerned with the outward, or we're concerned just with the end game, then we don't have to spend so much time in the hard work of dealing with the oppressed or the marginalized people and helping them in all this. And I think as we look at this stuff, as I mentioned, I'm not saying straight out that these examples are wrong or sinful, but what I am saying is I think looking at how is this approach affecting the marginalized people, I think that's a good sort of a little litmus test to see. If I want to bring somebody to Christ, as we've said in a lot of this, that in itself is not wrong if I believe that that the way of Jesus is right, and that the way of living is beneficial and brings out this life. But if I'm taking on these approaches that are actually hurting oppressed people, that are actually hurting or kicking aside these already marginalized communities, I may be participating in a way of empire. And going along with this too, we realized at some point, if we are looking at people as a sale, if we are looking at people as somebody to get onto our team, there's also this thread that's kind of worked its way into there, is there's money to be made in that. Now, like when I say look at people as a commodity, we've seen through sprouts of both mega churches, or even within the fields of Christian music industry and all these other things we're seeing, just going along with that Seven Mountain Mandate, all of entertainment and stuff, this is a whole industry, money to be made. If you guys are present on Instagram, how many of you have heard of Preachers and Sneakers? It's a pretty great comedy, but what I love about it is this Preachers and Sneakers account, all they do is they take these people that are in these high positions, and they will post a picture of them, and then on the side of the post, they will do just a monetary breakdown of the cost of their outfit that they're wearing. What's funny is seeing how defensive people get about this. Because everybody laughs and thinks it's funny until your guy is the guy up there. And I had a friend of mine get really upset because a worship leader that I actually really like and everything too, he was one of the guys. And I shared it because I thought it was funny. Because, oh yeah, this, look at this. He's got like $5,000 sneakers and all this stuff, but he's leading worship and everything. And my friend got really upset and was like, you know, he's making a lot of money from his stuff and he has every right to buy all this stuff. And I think there is this idea, it's not sinful for us to have money, okay? But again, where are we leveraging this position for our benefit in a way that maybe isn't practicing the way of shalom? I watched this happen through the COVID years, stuff which, you know, we're not totally out of, but there were some very prominent names, and I'm not going to do like naming name things, that used this conflict that was happening to then go out on concert tours and really show like we're going to stick it to them. And you look at it, there have been articles written about how much money one particular guy made on these tours through his industry, but he's the only employee. And millions of dollars he did by telling everybody that they didn't need to stay home, they could come to his big concert and all this stuff. And in doing that, they made jokes that, like, this is going to be a Jesus super spreader event, things like this. And looking at that and this idea that people were hurt, like I said, how is this approaching the marginalized, the weak? How is it treating those people? That, to me, is a way of empire and not a way of shalom. I feel like I'm getting a little off track, so we're going to move on to the next part. And this is going to be sort of my closing idea. But section 3 on this. So if we've used these places to leverage hierarchy in a way to leverage power, if we've used people and looked at them as a sale to be made and somebody to get over on my team so that we can kind of control these areas of life, at a certain point, we realize that we can't force everybody to think the way we think. We can't force everybody to feel the way we feel. Now, when that happens, my question going on here is, are we content to just demand that they act the way we want them to act? Are we okay with an outward appearance? We've seen examples of this where we want to, again, going back to a governmental thing, but we want to have the right people there. We want to vote in the laws, even if they're not making a difference, but it looks like, see, we don't care about this. I'll just be just straight out because I feel like I'm talking around issues here. Abortion. So are we content with saying that abortion should not be legal because we care about life? Or are we more concerned with whether or not lives are being harmed? So my example of this is, how many of you know about in the early church, and again, going back to the Roman Empire, have you heard of the practice of exposure? Me? Yeah, you got a few. Okay, yeah. If you've ever seen the movie 300, you've seen some of this too, throwing the babies out. I'm super moved. Maybe you heard a little in my voice as I'm thinking about this. I hadn't put this in here, but I'm super moved by the early church's approach to what was going on in their culture. The practice of exposure, what that is if a baby had blemish or if a baby was somehow not perfect in their sight when in this Roman culture, they would literally take it out to the dump heap and throw it out there to die. What the early church did in saying every human being is made in the image of God, deserving of dignity and love and respect, they would go in groups and walk around these dump heaps and they would find these discarded babies and take them in and raise them. Eventually, when the practice of exposure became outlawed, it was because people were so ashamed by seeing how these Christian communities were treating these lives. And they realized, we can't do this anymore. That might be an oversimplification, but there, I can see Catherine looking at me going like, uh-uh. No. That's my take on it, Catherine. No. But still, there's this idea that the church wasn't trying to find a position of power to change laws and be like, hey, you guys are bad, you gotta stop doing this. What they did is they lived in a way that showed where their values were and where their heart was. Are we living in that same way as I look in this? These roots of bitterness that have caused division and all this stuff, what I see is we are moving in a direction that says, as long as it looks this way on the outside, I'm good. Or if I can create my bubble to show that I'm on the right team, I'm good. If we can make it look Christian, or at least say that, and if I can tell people who are not doing what I have declared to be Christian values, if they're not living in those ways, they're on the outside and we're not like them, and look at the movement that I'm making that's saying you're wrong and I'm right. It's outward, whereas I believe that what I'm trying to say, so mixed up through all this, is shalom, our relationship with each other, is supposed to be coming from an inward or an inside-out movement. Are we being changed in our heart? Because I can act and do all the right things, but if God's not changing my heart, I can't truly live out this flourishing and abundant relationship with those around me. I believe it's the next slide. Oh, there we go. How many of you heard of Richard Dawkins? Yeah, the God delusion. Big player in the new atheist movement. This was a recent quote. I actually picked this up on the Holy Post, sticking with my Phil Vischer trip here. Richard Dawkins recently said, "I like to live in a culturally Christian country, although I don't believe a word of the Christian faith." I was convicted in hearing that, wondering, are we in that same boat? Obviously, we believe, or not obviously, but we say we believe in the Christian faith, but are we content with a culture around us that looks and feels Christian, even if it's not transformed, as I said, from the inside out in this way? When I started this off, I read some of those words from Paul, and they were right in line quoting Aristotle. And I told myself when I put this together, I'm not going to leave Paul out there to hang out to dry. I want to kind of play the role of a Paul apologist on this. But I want to go back and read. That was the beginning part when I read his household code about wives submitting to your husbands and slaves submitting to masters. Clearly, I edited that a little bit and just gave some parts. But I want to read the whole. So if you bear with me, I'm going to do a big chunk of reading here. And this is, I would say, sort of my answer to that. Are we okay with Dawkins' cultural Christianity if it is without Christ? In Colossians 3, Paul says, "Since we have been raised to new life with Christ, set your sights on the realities of heaven, where Christ sits in the place of honor and God's right hand. Think about the things of heaven, not the things of earth. For you died to this life, and your real life is hidden in Christ with God. And when Christ, who is your life, is revealed to the whole world, you will share in all his glory. So put to death your sinful earthly things lurking within you. Have nothing to do with sexual immorality, impurity, lust, and evil desires. Don't be greedy, for a greedy person is an idolater, worshiping the things of this world. Because of these sins, the anger of God is coming." Okay, you used to do these things when your life was still a part of this world. Now, and when I'm reading this, when I read the part that says world, maybe you can think of it in the sense of he's talking about a world ruled by empire. "But now the time to get rid of anger, rage, malicious behavior, slander, and dirty language. Don't lie to each other, for you have stripped off the old sinful nature and all its wicked deeds. Put on your new nature and be renewed as you learn to know your Creator and become like him." He seems to be concerned with who we are, not just what we do. "In this new life, it doesn't matter if you are Jew or Gentile, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbaric, uncivilized, slave or free. Christ is all that matters, and he lives in all of us." That seems already, as I've still got a little ways to go, but it seems already in contrast to what we may have taken from his household code. He goes on to say, "Since God chose you to be holy people he loves, you must clothe yourselves in tenderhearted mercy, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Make allowance for each other's faults and forgive anyone who offends you. Remember that the Lord forgave you, so you must forgive others. Above all, clothe yourselves in love, which binds us all together in perfect harmony, and let the peace that comes from Christ rule your hearts. For as members of one body, you are called to live in peace," or in shalom, "and always be thankful. Let the message about Christ in all its richness fill your lives. Teach and counsel each other with all the wisdom he gives you. Sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And whatever you do or say, do it as a representative of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God our Father." And now I'm going to move on to right where I started at the beginning. "Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting for those who belong to the Lord." Now, he already said that we're supposed to do all this stuff, being kind-hearted and everything. He said that there is no difference between slave or master. realizing that he's speaking into that context that Aristotle was talking about, that he was speaking into a world where that was the structure, and stepping out of that structure probably had some pretty harsh punishments even. If a wife decided that she was free and she could just stand up against her husband and all that stuff, there were probably some pretty intense backlash that could come from that. So Paul's already lined out this idea of who we're supposed to be. As Christians in general, we submit to each other. That's just how we do this. So he's speaking into that, saying, wives, submit to your husband. This is the law. This is how this works. But he moves on and says, husband, love your wives and never treat them harshly. Again, concerned with who we are in this. Love is beyond this. Children, always obey your parents, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not aggravate your children. Lord, forgive me for what I do every day, God. Fathers, do not aggravate your children, or they will become discouraged. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything you do. Try to please them all the time, not just when they are watching you. Serve them sincerely, because your reverent fear of the Lord, work willingly, working for the Lord rather than for the people. Remember that the Lord will give you an inheritance as your reward, and that the master you are serving is Christ. But if you do what is wrong, you will be paid back for the wrong you have done, for God has no favorites. I know even still in reading that, some of those words through the household code sound kind of harsh, but my point of what I wanted to get across as I close this out is that shalom is concerned with who we are. We have to, through Christ, be transformed. If I believe that Jesus is the embodiment of shalom, that he is the way, the truth, and the life, we cannot cultivate a relationship of shalom with those around us without being transformed through him or through his spirit. Cultural Christianity is never going to bring about a flourishing, abundant relationship with our neighbors. And if he is the way, this is going to that Hebrews verse right there. If he is the way, I believe we must be very, very, very careful not to assume that there is a goal in sight and that I am allowed to justify some other way to achieve that goal. This is not an end justifies the means situation. He's concerned that we are those kind-hearted, gentle, loving people from here out. And that root of, no, I have a different goal, and this way isn't working. This way is too slow. This way is too hard. Self-sacrifice, this all looks upside down. The king died on the cross and he's in the grave. This obviously didn't work. That's not part of the plan. That can't happen for us. We're not allowed to do that, because Jesus says these last words right here. That was a slide cue. Boom. All right. John 18, Jesus says, my kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. If it were, my followers would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish leaders. But my kingdom is not of this world. We're not going to use the tactics of empire and scratch for places of power. We're not going to look at people as anything other than fellow image bearers of God, fellow holders of the divine dignity placed on us. They're not a sale to be made. It's not somebody to manipulate. It's not somebody to bring over onto my team. These are fellow image bearers of God. And in that, we don't get to just skip past all the hard inner work to just get to the goal and figure out what's going to make it the easiest way. My charge to us as we move from this is, if we are seeking to love God and love our neighbors, and if we are seeking to share in this kingdom, go out and show that the garden is coming back, or we're returning to the garden. If we are making that declaration, we need to constantly be looking back like this and saying, is there a seed of empire that I'm allowing to sprout up? Is there some tactic that I'm using that is actually not bringing about flourishing and abundant life? but is using the ways of the earthly kingdom. We have to constantly check that on ourselves. I should have just ended on that verse, but I kept talking. But as we move out and do that, I love you guys. And I'm going to be doing this work too. And as you can see, I screw up as well. But I don't want us to give ourselves over to these roots and these seeds. I'm going to end on that. All right, you guys, I'm going to pass it back to Jared.
Thanks, Jeremy. Before we start these last couple songs, I just want to give you some time to think about it before.